Sunday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast, 15 and 60 on the Western Conference. Actually going to do this in two parts. We'll also do some news. Second part will get released on Monday. We're going to go in reverse alphabetical order, try to keep it fresh by starting with different teams, and also just because you probably have a tendency to not talk quite as much about the teams at the end. We're trying to keep it fair because we would never want any accusations of bias at all. We are sponsored today by MeUndies. Find out more about them at MeUndies.com/capspace. Movement Watches, MVMTWatches.com/capspace is the URL. And then our old standby, SeatGeek. Three sponsors today because we have a bit of a truncated week with Thanksgiving. SeatGeek, you can get $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase by entering that capspace code. Let's get started, Danny. Utah Jazz.
The Jazz are 7-7, 3-4 since the last time we did this. And my biggest takeaway from them, because they've been dealing with injuries to George Hill and various other guys, is that there is a very good team in here. They just need the chance to show it.
Yeah, and much like last year, 3.5 net rating, which of course is much better than a 500 team. And they really have been playing a bunch of games here without their best guys. Favors, again, has been out with this knee issue. He kept trying to play, wasn't able to go. He finally now is sitting out an extended period, but he already sat out an extended period during training camp and then came back, was playing limited minutes for a while. George Hill now with this thumb injury that he has supposedly been a game time decision on for like the last 9 games. It really, you don't see a lot of thumb injuries, hand injuries like that, that are not like a broken hand that are going to take this long to heal. So I am getting a little bit nervous there as well. And of course, Alec Burks has no timetable whatsoever for his return. Boris Diaw is kind of looking a little bit cooked for these guys too, and he's playing a lot. He's kind of a security blanket for Quinn. And then Trey Lyles is no good either at defensively at the four, so their defense is really beginning to suffer.
I've wanted them to play Withy more frequently. He did a nice job for them last year, particularly in Gobert's absence. But Quinn has felt more comfortable with Boris Diaw. It's been a little bit frustrating. But there are also good signs on, and just in terms of how they're doing this. So Gobert, he's second in terms of frequency of cuts, or is he second in terms of efficiency?
So yeah, one of the things I'm going to be doing a lot of for this episode was just going through the synergy play types. And it's not even so much as interesting to me about the actual efficiency at this point in the year, because your sample sizes are small, but it tells us more about how guys are playing, how they're being used. And when you talk about cuts, that generally is going to be dump offs, you know, your normal kind of backdoor cuts. But you'll see that the main guys who are leading in this category are big guys. And that's usually plays where someone drives down the lane. It's not necessarily a pick and roll roll guy, but someone drives down the lane and then dumps it off or throws an alley-oop or something like that. And so Gobert is number two in the league off of those, only 1.1 points per possession, which is not very good on those plays. If you think about those, are plays where you're being set up essentially right at the basket. And part of that's because of he's only shooting 60% of those shots. Again, not very good. Those are all shots really that are going to be at the rim. Turns it over a little bit, some free throws, but it does show that the Jazz guards are getting some penetration and finding him, and that he's making himself available. That was one of the things that we've criticized him for in past years, was not being able to get open enough when people would drive. And even if he is not that efficient compared to the rest of the league, 1.1 points per possession is still excellent in a vacuum. And so if he's getting a lot of those plays, that's fantastic. Derek Favors, however, has also been getting a lot of those, but he has had a really low points per possession, 0.94. that's in the 17th percentile league wide, and that I think is showing a little bit of that lack of lift that he has with that knee injury.
One of the most interesting pieces of reporting on the Jazz, or really on any team during these last 2 weeks since the last time we did the West, was from a Mark Stein piece. I think it was even just kind of like a lower note in the piece about how right now the Jazz are leaning towards giving a renegotiation and extension to George Hill over Derek Favors. And a little bit about the mechanics there is that they have to use cap space. They have this cap space available. They already agreed to an extension.
Yeah, they've got about $13 million. They've got about $13 million to use this year. That's going to kind of go away because of that extension, and then having to also, if they want to re-sign Gordon Hayward.
Right, and so both those guys are eligible for it, but realistically, you're probably only going to be able to give it to one. And the reporting about Hill is interesting because it is a legitimate choice. You can go either way. What were you thinking about it?
Well, I think that the events so far of this year have influenced that quite a bit. This is now, Favors always seems to have some chronic issues and then stuff that they can't really determine what it is. And it's hard for him to get back. Like, you remember he had those back spasms that cost him like 15 games last year. And then down the end of last year, he was trying to play on that sore knee, wasn't able to play. That probably cost him a game against Golden State. He basically wasn't himself for the last 2 weeks of the year. They make the playoffs probably if he's doesn't have those injuries. And then again, this year, it's becoming a concern. So questions with his durability popping up. Also, Dante Exum, during this time that Hill has been out, still proves that he is not quite ready yet. And it'd be interesting to see what it would take to get Hill done. I think, and maybe they also have had some discussions with Favors and they just haven't gone anywhere. This Hill extension, they can basically do it up until, I think, March 1st is your deadline. So you've got time. They could also wait until after the trade deadline, see if they want to use that cap space to take on more salary or get some more draft assets as well. And they will have Hill's bird rights. The beauty of the renegotiation extension, though, is that you can spend a bunch of money on him now that's basically kind of burning a hole in your pocket and then hopefully get him for a little bit cheaper, or you get him to lock in for less years. That's probably the bigger thing with Hill, with him going to be 31 in this off season. And they got to figure out what the extension rules are actually going to be in the new CBA. So you would have to imagine we won't see that happen until after December 15th, which the reporting has indicated all hope is that the new CBA will be done by that time. But I wanted to ask you, if you're George Hill and his agent, what would you take?
This is really his last chance to cash out, if you want to think about it that way. But the Jazz are a great situation for him because he can play on ball, he can play off ball, they're competitive. And so keeping all that in mind, I would be trying to get something in the 3 years, $50 million range as a free agent this summer. So if they can do part of that as a bonus this year, even better, you get that money right away. And I could understand, though, that maybe you negotiate that down to maybe prorated. So like, two more years and say about like 35-40, and you can put as much of you want. You can put $13 million of that on this season.
Now, it's going to be tough to calibrate some value here for some of the reasons that we've talked about. One of them being that I think there's going to be less money around the league in the aggregate than there was this year. Even if the cap does go up a little bit more, we still have forecasted that about half the teams aren't going to have significant space. And as we've said before, 27 of the 30 teams actually ended up using cap space in this last year, and many of them a very, very significant amount, well over $10 million. So in that market, you had Evan Turner, 4 years, $70 million. You had Luol Deng, 4 for $72 million. You had all these centers. You didn't have much in the way of a point guard market this year, just because of the vagaries of how it went. But George Hill is better than any of those guys that we mentioned. And he's actually, I think, the same age that Deng is going to be. He's a good shooter, so he might age a little bit better. He can kind of ease into a bench role, maybe. I mean, if I'm his agent, optimistically, you're thinking that's what you're going to get on the market. And George has been pretty healthy over the course of his career. I don't think he's that worried about injuries. And he's played really well so far this year, though he has this thumb thing. Presumably that'll resolve at some point. And if he keeps playing this well, you know, he's going to look even better. So if you can definitely get an extra, if you could get an extra $13 million this year, he's making $8 million right now in the last year of that 5 year, $40 million deal, which was a bad contract and then became a good contract because of the cap rise and his own improvement. So let's say you can get an extra 13 this year. Now you're going to sign another, you're thinking 3 years, $50 million on top of that 13 that you got this year.
Well, my idea with it would be that it would be less than that. Basically, it would be that would kind of be
priced. I think the problem is I don't think he takes that. Now, maybe that's about all he could get. He's probably fourth or fifth in the free agent point guard market behind Curry and Chris Paul, Kyle Lowry. And then he's kind of in the same range as Jeff Teague, who actually has been playing a lot better, played really well against Oklahoma City tonight. He's probably in the same range as Drew Holiday if Drew can stay healthy all season, and probably ahead of like Derrick Rose at that point. Those are all your starting point guards that are going to be available on the market this year. I think it's tough. Like, he's going to be wanting that kind of money, I think. And when you see the comparables from last year, we'll deserve it. But I think that last year's comparables are going to be a little bit of an aberration. It's just that none of the players are going to realize that. And so it's going to be hard to get deals done until you really get to the summer.
I agree with you on that. It will also be, it could be hard for Favors just because of the idea of, yeah, you're giving him a raise, but maybe he doesn't want to take the years in exchange. Like, you have a very different negotiation. And if Favors is asking for the moon, it makes it harder actually to come to a deal just because of the structures in place. And maybe you're willing to roll the dice, especially when he's been hurt as much as he has, and that, you know, that they can try out some of these smaller lineups and a lot of the different stuff out there. So if Favors is being aggressive with it going in, you know, going into this offseason, he probably thought it's me or nothing. And now all of a sudden that's not true. Also, the Jazz are, you know, they're still young. This is a very young team. Most of their best players are in their mid-30s. I think Gordon Hayward's 26, Hood is 24. You know, if you kind of consider those kind of guys the core of the team. So Hill is a little older than them. But as you said, he should age well, and he plays a position of immense value. And if they lose Hill, they're going to have to replace him with somebody else unless Exum really steps up. And I think that urgency is going to really take the lead here and could potentially make it more likely to get a deal done with him, because Favors is under contract anyway.
It'd be such a shame if Gordon Hayward just left this team in the offseason. And now if they offer him the full max 5-year full boat, I think he probably stays. That fifth year, I think, will be big for someone like him. As he goes into his late 20s. And then if Favors were to leave the year after and kind of never be healthy, if Hill were to leave, if they could never just, and they've struggled so much with health, if they could never get this full team on the floor over these last 2 years, that I think actually could be a really good team, that would be extremely disappointing. But it seems like the stars never aligned for them somehow.
It's not always fair. We want it to be. We want every team to reach their maximum potential, but there are times that you just have to be sitting there going, what if?
A couple other notes on their defense. They are doing a very good job at the things that they can control. One of those is that as a defense, only 10.4% of opponents' possessions occur in transition. That is the best in the league. The worst in the league, for just for some scale, is 17%. That's kind of what you can control a little bit as a defense. And so they're doing a great job there. They're doing a great job taking away opponents' number of three-point attempts. But as David Locke pointed out the other day, they are forcing basically no turnovers right now. And it's very hard to be an elite defense if you're not forcing turnovers. Quinn Snyder was saying that Dante Exum actually has taken a step back defensively, even as he's improved offensively. And he's actually has been more aggressive, though not necessarily that effective compared to, you know, some of the way Hill would be. So that'll be something to monitor, too, is some of their defensive fundamentals. We thought this team could be even potentially the best defense in the league. Without Favors, that's not going to happen. They don't have any good defensive fours. And playing someone like Joe Johnson at the four, or even Hayward, that's not going to get it done as far as being a great defensive team. They need him in there, too. But they have the personnel maybe to get there, but they are going to have to force a few turnovers. All right, we'll move on to the Spurs momentarily. But first, this from Movement Watches. I now actually have 5 relatives who have Movement Watches, and they, of course, were kind enough to send my girlfriend and I one, but my mom bought one. She loved it. And then she bought one for both of my cousins, her nieces, as well. It's really fantastic for men or women. And they look like absolute premium stuff. Classic design, quality construction, styled minimalism. They've sold over 500,000 watches in over 160 countries. But at a department store, you'd be having to pay $400 to $500 for a watch like this. Movement watches actually start at just $95. They go up to about $135. And if you use the vanity URL associated with the podcast, with free shipping and free returns, of course, you can get 15% off today. And there's no limit on how many times you can use that discount either. You do that by going to Movement Watches. That's MVMTWatches.com/capspace. Capspace is easy to remember. We're just talking about it, of course, with that George Hill potential renegotiation and extension. Movement Watches, MVMTWatches.com/capspace. Get your 15% off today on a watch that already is a fantastic price for the incredible quality that you're getting from them. MovementWatches.com, MVMTWatches.com/capspace is that URL. Join the movement. All right, where are the Spurs right now?
They are 10-3, 5-1 since the last time we did this, and they are tied for 5th in offense and 10th in defense. Not exactly what you expect from the San Antonio Spurs.
This actually is what I expected from them when you consider the personnel that they added. You look
at
their
front court historically, but you know.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't saying that you're in any way wrong there, but it just, in terms of this year, you look at, they added Pau Gasol, they lost Tim Duncan. LaMarcus Aldridge is another year older. Tony Parker is another year older. And as you would expect, with Gasol in the game, with Parker in the game, they can't stop anybody. However, they have been fantastic with those guys in the game offensively. And part of that is because Gasol has finally been taking more threes, something that you always wanted him to do with the Bulls. Now he's doing that on the Spurs. And I think the fact that he struggled a little bit for playing time early on was good for him. He's starting to conform a little bit more, maybe swallow his pride a little bit more. He's hitting 38.5%. 5% on those threes, taking more than 10% of his shots from downtown. LaMarcus also has taken some threes. He's hitting like over 50% on his limited attempts, which is pretty insane. And they're over 110 points per 100 on offense with those starters on the floor. Gasol also has been heating up. Some of these stats are as of Saturday, because it takes a lot of research to do this, so it's hard to update it sometimes. But he's scored in double figures for all of his last five games after only doing so twice in his first eight games.
The Spurs are in the process of figuring out something compelling because they have more specialists, less generalists this year. But I've also really liked the way they played with Danny Green. I've been a fan of Danny Green's for a while now. And when you have a weaker defensive center like they do when Dwayne Dedmon's not on the floor, they need a defender like Danny Green. But also, he's making almost 40% of his threes. I think that's enough considering the defensive value he provides.
Yeah, he had that huge slump last year, just could not get out of his own way shooting three-pointers. Still was great on defense, of course. But yeah, he's up to a 19.3 net rating only over the course of five games because he had that quad injury and then I think another injury I can't recall. He missed a couple of games, but he's been fantastic. And they've needed that because you remember how John Simmons was like 6 out of 6 or 5 out of 5 or from three in his first game against Golden State.
Yeah,
he may not have hit a single three since then because he's now shooting 18.8% from three-point range.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a problem for a guy who you thought would be part of the answer to their perimeter rotation. And we talked before the season, the Spurs were one of our favorite teams to think about with this because they were going to need contributions from players who weren't big factors last year. John Simmons is someone who a lot of people like. We've thought about him at Summer League even before he signed with the Spurs. And he needs to bring more than this if it's going to be him. They have other options. You know, Kyle Anderson is going to be one. That's part of the reason why Danny Green being back helps. But the hope was Simmons would be a part of that solution. He still can be, but it's been a struggle since he dunked on JaVale McGee at the end of game one.
Yeah, I thought that he should be in the rotation, and then Kyle Anderson really hasn't been much better. I think he has a PER under 10, not a guy who's going to be making up for it with stellar individual defense either. Dwayne Dedmon though has been great. He's missed the last couple of games with knee soreness, but when he has played, he has a 9% two-point block rate, which is absolutely insane. That'll come down a little bit, but that's like leading the league levels of shot blocking. And they have a 91.2 defensive rating with him on the floor, which is, of course, would be, you know, beyond league leading level. So that's, it's very interesting to see, even with Simmons too, he is a solid defender. Patty Mills as well, pretty good on D. They can throw out, even with David Lee, an excellent defensive unit on that second unit if they're going to play Kawhi as well, or they can go with the offensive group. Now, I think I'm still very skeptical of how that's all going to work out in the playoffs with the Clippers playing so well, although they've come back to earth a little bit these last three games. You still would imagine that they look like the favorite over San Antonio if those two teams were to match up. A little bit more on Kawhi Leonard too. He has run 70 pick and roll possessions that he's finished with a shot or a turnover, averaging an unbelievable 1.16 points per possession. The league average on those plays is usually about 0.8. You'll recall that pick and roll ball handler and isolations and post-ups, kind of those individually created plays, are the ones that are much less efficient. Those are usually around 0.8 points per possession. And then the plays where you're getting fed on spot ups or roll man or cuts and stuff, those are usually more efficient. So for him to be doing that with the ball in his hands, that, again, it's going to come down, but he's been incredible there. But on defense, he actually has not had quite the team effect that we've seen in past years. So do you think Kawhi hasn't quite had the level of defense that we've seen, or is it more just the guys that he's playing with?
He has a much heavier load this year, with especially when they were doing Parker and Pau together. So a lot of it, I would say, is based on that. But, you know, he has a different, I don't think he has been, when I've watched, he hasn't been as dominant as he was last season. So I think it'll get closer to that, but maybe not just pushing up right against the top of DRPM.
Yeah, he's not even on the first page for that right now. Those rankings just came out. Obviously, very early on for those, very small sample size, and also, you know, not a be-all end-all in terms of determining who the best players are on offense and defense. But it is interesting to see just that they have not defended as well with him on the floor as in past years, and we'll dig into more of whether he's actually slipped or just what's around him next time we get a chance to watch the Spurs. Let's get to Sacramento now. Is this train wreck that we saw maybe happening? I guess it's kind of happened over the last five games since we talked about them.
Yeah. So Sacramento Kings 4-9. This is before they're playing right now as we record this, so it doesn't include this Toronto game. They're 1-4 in their last five, 16th in offense, 28th in defense. And after their last game, after their loss, Dave, I think it was against the Spurs, Jaeger said, "I've seen enough. We're going to play small." And his reaction to that was playing Collison and Lawson together, Barnes, Gay, and Cousins as their starting five.
And that makes sense to me in some respects, because they just don't have anyone who can do anything off the dribble. And Jaeger had made the point that Lawson was really struggling, and he had been horrible on transition possessions, 0.29 points per possession as 18 transition possessions, a ton of turnovers, and that just shows basically that they aren't trying to run at all. And then on that ESPN broadcast on Friday, Jaeger made the point that, hey, they don't have any personnel to run with him. And the other thing that Jaeger said too was basically DeMarcus is going to play center. And he has to play center because if he's playing next to Kufos or playing next to even a Cauley-Stein, which they haven't done much of, he's got to guard guys on the perimeter. He's way too slow to do that. He carries way too big of an offensive load. He doesn't have the discipline to do that. He doesn't have the type of stamina to do that. It's just not going to work for him to guard anyone outside the paint on a regular basis. So he's got to play center. He's better there. You get some spacing around him. You can get some points in transition, and at least maybe they can score a little bit then, because you know what? Playing big, the defense sucked anyway.
And that's where I wanted to go with this, is there are a lot of teams that are playing big in particular, and the reason you do that is defensively, whether that is rim protection, defensive rebounding, or both. And when your defense is still bad, what are you doing it for?
The other thing is that Kufos has been horrible offensively. He's another one of these guys who's in the top 10 off a cut because teams aren't guarding him, so anytime the Kings drive, he's open. But he's got, you recall from watching him, he'll go to this floater because he doesn't have any explosion to finish at the rim, and he's not really deft enough to take a dribble and go around people. So he'll just catch the ball at the dotted line and throw up a floater, and those are 40% shots. Usually guys on cuts are going in for a layup or a dunk. So he's at 0.74 points per possession off cuts, and he's one of the guys who takes the most of those shots in the league. That's really just miserable. Those are shots that should be very efficient, and those possessions are going to die. He's turning it over on 18.5% of those possessions. How do you turn it over on a cut where you're just supposed to catch the ball and shoot immediately? I have no idea how he's doing that.
Particularly when most of the turnovers that you think of on cuts are related to the pass, and usually those turnovers are laid at the feet of the passer, not at Kufos.
Right. A little bit more on Cousins. He's just high usage in just about every area. He is among the league leaders in post-ups and ISOs, and continuing a trend that we talked about in a 15 and 60 last year, he's much more effective on post-ups, which is basically getting the ball closer to the basket, than ISOs. Now, the line between an ISO and a post-up, for those new listeners, for these, you know, it's all subjective, where if you turn around 20 feet from the basket and kind of have your back to goal and catch the ball and then turn and fade, is that an ISO or a post-up? But it's safe to assume that the closer to the basket you catch the ball initially, the more likely it's going to be assumed to be a post-up. And so he's at 0.93 on post-ups, 0.79 on ISOs. At least he's got about double the number of post-ups, although he is, again, among the lead leaders in both. And the other thing that's really interesting, there's some interesting leaders in this category, is he's sixth in the league on spot-ups. Part of that is because he can just shoot three-pointers all day when he's being guarded by a center. They're not going to get out there and guard him. But that also, the spot up category includes not only just shooting a jumper, but off of somebody else's pass, but also then actually driving off of a closeout as well. And so he does a fair amount of that when these lumbering centers try to get out at him at the 3-point line. So it shows that he has a lot of versatility to his offensive game. And I mean, certainly offensively, he's been the only guy on this team, maybe Rudy Gay to some extent, who's been playing well.
He's a phenomenal talent in that way. And the idea of spot ups is something that I would love to see a lot, even more from Karl Towns, because they have similar skill sets. Their bodies are so different, but they have both have the ability of attacking that, especially off a center. But with Cousins, I did a little bit of digging on what I'm calling the one-man teams of the Western Conference, and so Boogie is certainly one of those.
A lot of those this year. A lot of those.
Yeah. So before tonight's game, when Cousins was on the floor, the Kings are scoring 107.6 points per 100 possessions, and they're scoring 93.4 when he's on the bench.
Yeah. I mean, we can call that the Cousins. We can call that the Harden. I mean, there's still that negative 1.7 net rating with him in the game, which is actually worse than it's been in past years. And their defense is a little bit worse with him on the floor too, which is not a surprise. I think he can have some moments on occasion, but he's also going to have a lot of lazy transition efforts and not going to get out on shooters, et cetera. The other thing that's been interesting is they really have decreased the pace a ton from last year. They've been pretty low in pace, and that would in theory make sense when you're playing with two bigs, you're trying to get the ball into Cousins. But again, I think Jaeger just sees, hey, we're not doing well enough offensively. We're gonna now, with Lawson and with Collison, two really speedy guys, if not as skilled, they're going to try and push the pace, get out in transition, and then if they can't get something, try and get Cousins working.
The dual point guard thing bothers me for a couple reasons. One being that those are their only two point guards, unless they're going to play Garrett Temple at the one, and so you need to stagger them. You can start and stagger them if you're going to play them enough minutes, but also I don't consider either one of them a strong spot up guy, and so I understand the idea of having
Collison
shot
is okay
on the floor.
I'd rather have Collison shooting threes than Aflalo.
What about McLemore?
I mean, he seems to be like totally out of the rotation now, so
that's true. He does, I think we both like Caspi better, which is another way to resolve this. But
yeah, there's still like rumblings that he wants a trade. He doesn't want to trade now. The report was that he just had a meeting to talk about how he wasn't being used and how he thinks he can really help the team, and he happens to be right about that. and then Aflalo has just been bad too. His stats on the year, 8.9 PER, you know, like, and he's not really much good on defense either. He doesn't get any rebounds. I mean, you'd like to see him get, he's probably got like one offensive rebound on the year. He's a guy who, like, he's closer to the basket some, maybe he could fly in. He's not helping on the defensive glass. He never passes, 4.2% assist percentage, no steals, no blocks. At least he never turns it over, but when you never do anything, it's hard to turn it over, and you never pass. So he just has not been worth the money. At least it's only really 1 year with a little bit of a guarantee next year in his contract. Same thing with Tolliver. I thought that he might be able to help them. He's been kind of dropped out of the rotation a little bit too. So maybe we'll see more of Caspi now. This will be their first game. And Lawson, I think, had like a monster game in the second half, the first time he really was able to get off at all offensively. So I think that was part of the reason that they are going with this new, quicker lineup. See if they can get some more dynamic offense out of there. I don't think it's going to work, but it's desperate time for these guys. They're 4-9 and they have had a hard stretch. We predicted that if they weren't able to win you think really back to that game against the Lakers, that was the one that they had to have to really get to 500, because they had this really hard stretch coming up, and instead they lost that.
You ready to move on to the Portland Trailblazers and MVP candidate Al-Farouq Aminu?
Yeah, 8-7, 4-4 since we last checked in on them. Pretty amazing the way they've been playing, that they are still in the positive. They did have a nice win where they blew out the Nets today.
Did you watch that game? It was horrendous.
Yeah, I was traveling from Chicago to Indiana. I'm actually here now. I was at Bucks Warriors last night, and then I'm going to be at Warriors Pacers tomorrow. I'm staying at my aunt's house in Indy as we record this, so I did not see that. But I mean, pretty awful. 15th in offense now, which is, how are these guys only 15th in offense with the amazing talent that they have? That's actually more surprising to me than the now 30th in defense.
They're both surprising. They've still, I think, from what I remember, they've done well when Lillard and McCollum are on the floor. They do have these struggles, especially now that their bench is messed up because of Aminu being out and just trying other guys, and that's in the starting spot that is now created. They've struggled a little bit in that and just getting to their equilibrium, and surprise surprise, one of the guys who's not helping as much is Evan Turner.
Yeah, you can I say gleefully, is that too strong? Noted.
I would say glibly, but whatever.
That he was dead last in the first edition of RPM rankings. I think he might, you know, he's like negative like 120 or something on the season. But it's not only his fault. I mean, you would like to think that, hey, if Al-Farouq Aminu goes out, that maybe one of the two wings that you're paying $18 million a year would be worth starting in his place. But instead, you know, they've had to start Myers Leonard, who is just an absolute sieve defensively, especially at the four, like he and Plumlee in the front court, and then Lillard and McCollum in the backcourt. Like, how are you ever going to stop anybody with that lineup? So you just have no chance there. And Turner, of course, has been awful on offense as well. He has taken 49 possessions already, which is a lot for kind of a secondary guy as a pick and roll ball handler. 0.67 points per possession there. That is awful. And then he is also 0.52 points per possession on the 25 spot ups that he has used so far.
That's Markieff Morris-esque, because I think Markieff was worst on spot ups last year. And something broader picture for them that is a real concern, and you mentioned about the idea of their defense, is that that they had a 104 defensive rating before Aminu, before the first game where he got hurt. And now, and in the game since, they're at a 111.7. And you can't be that dependent on one player, especially your power forward, for all of your defense if you're going to be competitive. Because Aminu is good. We both really like him, but he's the third best player on this team.
Yeah, and even despite the fact that he'd had a very difficult shooting start to the season, he was still helping. And I think Harkless can still be decent, but he's a little bit overmatched as the first guy as your stopper. I mean, Harkless actually has been pretty efficient this year so far, and with a 57% true shooting, that's a nice step up for him. His three-point shooting now, he's at 43% on three-pointers. That's going to come down, but still pretty effective. They just have no one to play next to him. And I think you just have to go with Crabbe. I think I would just start Crabbe, because any of these guys that you're going to, who's a traditional big, Leonard isn't any good, and he's going to kill your defense. He's not that good on offense either. All he does is shoot three-pointers. Ed Davis, they tried starting him a little bit. He's just, you're not going to have the level of spacing that you need with him out there. Vonleh still is not ready yet either. I would just say, screw it. Like, we're going to start Crabbe, we're going to start Harkless, and we're just going to outscore you and see if that can get him there, because they really, and then the other thing too is that Plumlee has been really inefficient so far too. Plumlee, only 53% true shooting. Like, this is a guy who in theory is supposed to just be going up and dunking alley-oops, and that's all he's going to do. Somehow he's actually pretty much league average in true shooting. That's no good. On cuts, which we mentioned again, he's really inefficient on cuts. That shows that he's just not able to finish at the rim over any kind of a contest. We saw that difficulty from him in the playoffs last year, and I think that that scouting report is carried over to this year, where they realize that when he gets the ball, you don't want to let him make a pass off of those pick and roll traps. You want to actually make him finish, and he's not capable of doing that.
He is limited in that way. That was something, yeah, the Warriors really did capitalize on that. And I don't know that the league has necessarily followed suit. It's just the situations that present themselves. And his defensive limitations are rearing their head without Aminu as well. And you get into these complicated spots of, okay, is it going to be Crabbe? Is it going to be Leonard? And neither one of those are great options. They've also tried Ed Davis in that spot a little bit. And that has some limitations in terms of spacing. Lillard is still doing a really nice job finishing. He had a gorgeous finish over Brook Lopez today, where Lopez had no idea he was even going to throw it. It looked like Lillard just kind of like threw it over his head, but he knew what he was doing. And so he's had a few of those nice moments. The Nets absolutely could not defend him today. And for those of you who enjoy white 7-foot guys shooting threes, Justin Hamilton and Myers Leonard were just bombing in Sunday's game. It was actually vaguely fun.
Yeah, white American 7-foot guys. So I think actually Justin Hamilton has some kind of European citizenship. I think he might be like Croatian or something. But yeah, you know what? I think these guys still, while I took the under on them, I think they're like, you know, under 46, I think is what it was that I took, or 46 and a half. And I worry that they might take a step back this year. I still think that they, when they are at full strength, can be good. It's just that good is not good enough. When you talk about some of the talent, the high-end talent this team has, you're just not getting anything out of some of these reserves. But as you noted, their regular starting five, when they're together, still plus 15.3, and that lineup killed all last year too. So if they can just get that back together, I think they can be all right.
And their bench will work itself out. They're a team that has enough talent. I wish they had spent a little bit of money, even getting back their old friend Tim Frazier, just somebody who could be a backup one to have another guy on the roster. Napier was a worthwhile flyer, but not more than that, and it would help. But they have enough guys, you know. The Blazers,
well, I mean, the guy that they thought was going to be that guy was Evan Turner, to have the ball in his hands more,
right?
You know, that he could be a pseudo third point guard, and you know, we know how that went.
Ready to move on?
Well, you did note their clutch. Did you talk about how they're doing in the clutch?
Oh, that's right, I did a little bit in that. So they are plus 16.3 and 6-2 in some ways, more importantly, in clutch situations. But it's worth noting, we're dealing with small sample sizes here. They've only played 35 minutes, and a fair portion of those were in two games where the Nuggets absolutely collapsed, and so the Nuggets fell apart, and also then that Nuggets game went to overtime, so that also logs in the minutes. But that's a nice thing in terms of like what you can hang your hat on moving forward, because if they're good in close games, that can make the margin. I mean, we both expect them to be a playoff team, but you know, winning a few extra games in that way can make the difference between, let's say, the 6 seed and the 4 seed, or the 8 and the 6, or something like that.
what's going to happen if the Nuggets and the Sixers ever play a game that goes into clutch time? Like, are they just going to, like...
The only points are in transition off the other team's turnovers.
Yeah, like, are they just going to stand at half court and just continually throw the ball to one another, like, without ever even, like, getting on offense? Like, those two teams are so bad in the clutch so far this year. The poor Nuggets, I mean, how many, like, that Raptors game a couple days ago that they couldn't pull out? Like, I mean, we're not the Nuggets section yet. One other thing, too, Dame Lillard leading the... Oh, no, I'm sorry. I think he's, like, second or third in the league. Second, I think, behind Russell Westbrook. 148 possessions already that he's using as the pick-and-roll ball handler. Quite efficient on those, 1.03 points per possession. CJ, another 83 of those, 0.92 points per possession. This is a team that uses a lot of plays like that. And while they have some of the best guys in the league at it, you're still, if you're the ball handler is shooting on the pick-and-roll, those plays are inherently less efficient than if he can draw help and make a pass. And, you know, we'll see whether Dame can keep up the level that he's at on the pick and roll. He is one of the best in the league, but it's hard when, you know, I think teams are just kind of living with that a little bit more. And the other thing too is that they don't have the three-point shooting that they did earlier in the year when they're going with some of the two bigs, or Leonard. I think there's a little bit less respect for him. All right, who do we got next here?
Phoenix Suns, a team that I think is kind of sadly settling into a niche of sorts of competitive losses. They're 4-10. This was their second straight stretch that we've done this where they were 2-5, 21st in offense, 25th in defense.
Yeah, and their projection now for the season via our friends at 538, I think it's just interesting to note this. Wait, what? This can't be right. Our friends at 538 are actually projecting them to go 39-43. Oh, wait, that's because I'm looking at last year. This is as of the very beginning of last year. I looked at it and I was like, wait a minute. Golden State, New Orleans, Detroit, Atlanta, Chicago, Cleveland.
If it looks too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah, I was like, why can't I find this? Because I was looking at the bottom of the standings. I'm like scrolling up, like, where are the Suns? Why are they not in like the bottom five here? And they're like right in the middle. Like, what is going on? I don't know why I even said that. That is terrible. But fortunately for our listeners, or unfortunately, depending on your thinking, we don't do much editing on this show. The real Suns are projected at 28-54 with a negative 5.1 point differential with their current 4-10 record. And that seems about right to me, that 28-54. They have, again, been relying a ton on pick and roll ball handler plays. If you are watching a Suns game, you're going to see the pick and roll ball handler do a ton, because on defense, they have the highest percentage in the league on pick and roll ball handler plays by opponents. And I'm not sure how much of that is due to just their design and how much of that is due to kind of ineffectiveness. And then on offense, Bledsoe, 102 possessions there already, 1.09 points per possession. That's fantastic. So basically 10 a game, almost. Well, I guess they've played 14 games now, so a little bit less than that. But Bledsoe, a lot of possessions in pick and roll. And then the other thing that's interesting with this team that makes a lot of sense is they are one of the lowest teams that shoots coming off of screens. That's another one of these categories, basically, where you're shooting a jump shot, generally coming off a screen. You'd like to see a little bit more of those plays for Devin Booker. Again, he's been working mostly with the ball in his hands, has not been very efficient so far this year, below the league average in true shooting percentage. And maybe Booker is just not that good yet at coming off of screens. But I think with the skill that he has, he's really the only like really good shooter on this team too. It would be nice if they could get him the ball in those situations a little bit more. And that's something that maybe could bend the defense as opposed to him just trying to attack and pick and roll all the time.
Yeah, it does seem like they can add more wrinkles to this. Something that I was looking up was Alex Len, by virtue of being one of the centers who didn't sign an extension, he becomes one of these fascinating figures because he'll be restricted and we'll see how the market chills or doesn't chill for him. He is like about a league average PER. I think he's around 16, but he has a 0.523 true shooting percentage, which isn't great, and is almost identical to what Tim Duncan had last year and what Kyle O'Quinn had last year. So you want him to be a little bit more efficient. He's very comfortable taking these mid-range shots that go in a fair, it's not like his stroke is bad, but I kind of wish he was a little bit more selective about what he did on the offensive end.
Yeah. I mean, we've been saying that about him for a long time, and he actually has gotten more efficient than last time we looked at this. He was only at 48% true shooting, but he still is by far the worst net rating on the team, negative 14.6. The fact that they're starting him and Marquise Chris, negative 14.4 net rating, and that is really, you're starting every game now in a huge hole. And I think TJ Warren, Devin Booker, Eric Bledsoe, probably the three guys you would most identify as the core of this team, I think they're really now being dragged down by playing with those other two guys who kind of, especially on defense, don't really know what they're doing a ton. Encouraging, however, for this team, three guys, all of whom are favorites of advanced stats, who are very young players, inexperienced, playing behind some of these other guys like Chris and Len. Alan Williams, 12.6 net rating in 58 minutes. He had this unbelievable game against the Pacers where they blew them out without Paul George in Indiana, where he had 15 points and 15 rebounds in 26 minutes, 8 offensive rebounds. So he's been pretty good. I'm looking forward to seeing a little bit more from him. He's a guy that KP has always loved, I think out of UC Santa Barbara, played in China last year, but has always killed it in summer league. Very good in the advanced stats, but kind of one of these ground-bound center types. And then Dragan Bender, he's played 10 games, only 96 minutes, not very much, although Earl Watson did say that he wanted to get him some more time when I interviewed him after that Warriors game the other day. It hasn't really materialized, but they've been very good when Bender has been on the floor, 11.2 net rating. And I think while he himself has not had great statistics, and most of that's offense, actually, I mean, they're still giving up 110 per 100 with him on the floor, but scoring 121, which is amazing when you consider the offense that this team has without him. But I think with him spacing the floor a little bit more, especially if he's even playing center on the second unit, which he's been doing a little bit, or at least playing with a guy like Tucker as well, maybe that's an indication that he could be effective. And then Tyler Ulis as well, only played 7 games, 81 minutes, 10.3 net rating when he is on the floor. And they've also been positive with all the old vets on the floor, Chandler, Barbosa, Dudley. They're in the positive with all those guys. I mean, again, it's, if you're trying to win this year, it's ridiculous that Chris is starting over Dudley, but you know, that's fine that Chris is considered the future. So with all that said, I mean, this is just kind of a chaotic year. I think Watson has always had some kind of chaotic rotations. You throw in the fact that they're trying to develop some of these guys. You throw in the fact that Tyson Chandler's only played 8 games due to the death of his mother. All of those things, really, there's very little consistency to this team, but they have had some things that have worked on this squad at times.
They have. I like Bender a lot. I much prefer him in a second unit context as a center than as a power forward, just because it creates awkwardness for defenses. And Ulis, been a fan of his for a long time as a kind of a second unit distributor. And something that he did, he had 4 steals in that game against the Pacers. He's averaging 1.9 steals per game. And you say, oh, you know, that's pretty good. Yeah, he's averaging 11 and a half minutes a game, and he's getting his 1.9. It's incredible. He's small guy, but he can get in there. He's a pest in that way, and he's also a good distributor. I would love to see them play him more, and that ties in with the idea of just kind of consolidation or clarification of their rotation. And I'm not going to say, you know, oh, they should trade Brandon Knight to clear minutes for Tyler Ulis or something like that. They should trade Brandon Knight because there's no point in having Brandon Knight on this team.
Yeah, assuming they can get something for him. Knight actually has started picking it up. He had over 30 points earlier. He had a really rough start to the year. But you know, remember, he missed a ton of time last year, too. And one other note, too, they are worst in the league, allowing 1.1 points per possession on isolations. As we mentioned, usually 0.8 is all you allow in those. They do not have a ton of great isolation defenders on this team. But you know, guys like Chris,
Devin Booker.
I mean, Bledsoe is really the only guy. Warren is only not really that good at that either. Now, that could just be that nobody ever shoots that well in isolations. I mean, that's like the best player in the league doesn't do that at isolation. So that's probably just unlucky. It's going to come down a little bit. Maybe you guys are shooting really well on mid-rangers, but there'll be something to check in on again in a little bit to see whether they just have nobody who can stop anybody one-on-one on this team, or is that just unlucky?
Yeah.
You ready to go on?
The Oklahoma City Thunder, 8-6, 3-5 since the last time we did this. A lot of that has been coming back to earth. They're now 23rd in offense, 5th in defense, and had what was, as somebody who watched the end of the game and overtime, a pretty rough loss against the Pacers in Oklahoma City.
Yeah, let's talk about that game a little bit. I didn't see much of it. No Paul George in that one. Jeff Teague went crazy. Was he just doing that at the expense of Russell Westbrook? Like, how was he able to go off against this Thunder team?
I think he did a lot of that damage earlier in the game than the part that I was watching. He did have a couple of nice finishes where he got a little bit of separation and got past guys, but it was a lot of different things. Oklahoma City has this really strange propensity for a team that's fifth in defense to just have these horrendous stretches where they're just giving up everything. And there were a few of those where, like, Monte was getting loose. Teague was 3 of 4 in his threes tonight. We talked earlier in the Time to Panic episode about how he's struggling. He's still at 26% for the year. And so they were letting those guards get too much penetration. And you would think, and normally, you know, Steven Adams does a pretty good job of mitigating that, but today that wasn't working as much. And also they were getting a fair amount of tough shots to fall. But without Paul George, there isn't really much there for the Pacers offense, but they were still able to, you know, they scored 115 and went to overtime. It helped that they were 11 of 22 from three. I mean, they were making, and a lot of those were kind of inconsistent. They weren't necessarily the greatest looks and they were just falling, but
yeah, giving up only 22 three-pointers in an overtime game, that's actually like not bad defense.
No, that's not bad at all. And they did give up a lot of free throws and everything like that. And one of the plays, and the Oklahoma City announcers did not like this very much, was Steven Adams kind of got into Miles Turner's airspace in, I think it was the end of regulation, and drew what ended up being a two-shot foul, even though he was at a three, and the announcers were mad about it, but it was the right call. And so that helped push the game to overtime. And then in overtime, Indiana was just a little bit better and got the win.
Another note that you had here is, again, this is another one of these lone wolf teams where they're so dependent on what Russell Westbrook is doing.
Yes. So they are plus 8.2. This was before today's game. They were plus 8.2, 105.9 per 100 offense, 97.7 on defense when Westbrook's on the floor, which he is for a vast majority of their minutes. Then when he's off, that goes from plus 8.2 to minus 19.5, and their offense drops by almost 20 points per 100 possessions.
Yeah, and the defense actually goes up as well. I think part of that is just that he and Adams very much mirror their minutes together. And so, and Adams has a very good net rating in addition to Westbrook. I've talked about maybe they want to split those guys up, especially because there's been a lot of talk out of Oklahoma City how Adams just has not been able to get rolls to the rim because there hasn't been that much space. So maybe, again, you go to get Westbrook and Cancer together, you still have that pick and roll kind of balance out a little bit more, and then when Westbrook's off the floor, get Adams back in there and kind of go for the scoreless tie type of approach. We've advocated that Houston try that as well when Harden is off the floor. Samaje Christen has not been very good so far this year. He's only averaging 0.62 points per pick and roll possession. On the other hand, Westbrook leading the league, 153 pick and roll possessions before tonight's game, and he has been extremely efficient on those and extremely efficient overall this year, which is really impressive. He's never been incredibly efficient. I think he's actually on pace right now, off the top of my head, for the most efficient season of his career. And you consider just the incredible load that he's under. Actually, let's look this up and see where he's at in terms of like a usage rate and efficiency standpoint. This is probably something we should talk about on like every single one of these, because, you know, he's always a threat to come close to leading the leading NBA history in usage rate. Yeah, right now 40.5% usage, but 57% true shooting, 32 PR right now, 57% assist percentage. That's how an estimated the percentage of teammates' field goals that he assists while he's on the floor. So that is like, that usage is just the number of shots and turnovers that he has, and then you also throw in the number of assists he's getting. Like, he's really probably,
his assist percentage is 57.3. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's when you throw that in, if he's assisting on that number, then he's probably has some of his potential assists are even more than that. I mean, Seth did that piece on him 2 years ago when he was by himself, basically saying that when you threw his true usage, which is basically his shots, turnovers, and then plays that he's potentially assisting, you know, he's probably right in that range, 70 or 80% of those when he's on the floor.
Something Kevin Pelton articulated last year that really struck me, and I think is maybe more true of Westbrook if it continues, is that Stephen Curry, part of the reason he was the unanimous MVP last year is that he was able to step up his usage, step up the amount of possessions that he was a part of, while also increasing his efficiency. And Westbrook has a lot farther to go in terms of efficiency part of it. That's just never been the strength of his game. But to go from last year, 31.6% usage to 40.5, that is a gargantuan jump. To go from that and be more efficient is incredible.
Let's talk a little bit more about how they're getting their offense. I think that this is instructive, again, in addition to what Westbrook is doing, to show what they've been effective at and kind of how they've been struggling as well. Only 1.5% of their possessions are classified as off screens. They have nobody on this team who can come off a screen and make a jump shot. That just shows you how little shooting they have. If it's someone other than Westbrook making the play, actually Enes Kanter, they ran him off a screen to the corner the other day for a three-pointer. But they never ever do that, basically, right? That's because they have no shooters. They don't really have that as an option of something to go to. They are first by quite a bit in the percentage of their points that come in transition. I think like 17% of their possessions come in transition, which is a ton. Steven Adams, 0.57 points per post-up. 23% of his post-ups are turnovers. Enes Kanter, 0.58 points per post-up. 27% of his post-ups are turnovers. Again, along with the off-screens, this shows that there is no spacing for these guys to be posting up. When you have a high turnover rate in the post, that's almost always because guys are digging down. And then, of course, Kanter and Adams, not exactly renowned for their passing, they're not going to be able to pass out of that. They're probably going to turn it over. But it all starts really with that lack of spacing. And then, of course, Kanter, he has 29 possessions as the role man, 1.34 points per possession, which is awesome. He's always been fantastic as the role man. That's one of the best in the league. Why don't we move on to New Orleans here? But first, a word from our friends at MeUndies. Pretty simple to sell this. This is the most comfortable pair of underwear that I have ever owned. I have a few pairs that they sent me. I've bought a few more. And when the wash is done, always the first ones that I wear without fail. The secret is sustainably sourced Modal, a special fabric made with best-in-class raw materials that are proven to be 3 times softer than cotton. You can get these only on the MeUndies website. And of course, you'll enjoy free shipping in the U.S. and Canada. Everyone in my audience, of course, gets 20% off their first order. Also lets them know that you came from us. And go to that special URL, MeUndies.com/capspace. Capspace, easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. And with their better day guarantee, if they aren't the most comfortable, best feeling underwear you've had, they'll refund you and let you keep your first pair for free. So 20% off that first order at MeUndies.com/capspace. That's MeUndies.com/capspace. Don't forget that URL to let them know that you came from us. New Orleans Pelicans, where are they at?
So they are 4-10, and they're 4-4 since the last time we did this because they were 0-6, and it was, you know, in that plenty of time to panic. And the most notable part about that, they're 25th in offense, 14th in defense, is that they've had 2 games back with Jrue Holiday, and they are 2-0.
Yeah, that first game, we'll talk a little bit about what his performance was. He had 21-7 in 23 minutes. He didn't look like he was that quick. He's more of a kind of take your time pace kind of guy. He's got a lot of length, not incredibly athletic. He's put on a little bit of weight. He's getting into close to his late 20s now, so he's not going to be quite as dynamic off the dribble in terms of finishing at the rim. But he's just an adult on this team, right? Like, he can shoot when you go under on the pick and roll. He can shoot really anywhere in the process if you're on his back, if you lay off a little bit too much. And of course, he's fantastic finding the role man, Anthony Davis, as well. Tim Frazier, they really started playing him for the pass a lot. He was good setting up AD, but teams weren't really worrying about him shooting the jumper or even necessarily getting all the way to the rim due to his size. So he just has this great understanding of how to run things. He's big enough to kind of bump guys off him, get to his spots. I mean, he's almost playing like the point guard version of Joe Johnson in a way, like just taking his time, using his body, getting to where he wants to go, finishing over a smaller player if he needs to, shooting a mid-ranger, and then even if he's going really slowly, he forces the defense over to him, and then he's able to find AD on these rolls. Or AD also is very effective finishing off his misses on the offensive glass in these first 2 games.
The Pelicans did a good job getting potentially capable ball handlers in their, you know, in their kind of orbit during this offseason. Frazier, Langston Galloway, Etuan Moore, but they still needed Jrue Holiday to be Jrue Holiday because he pushes everybody down into the right role. And even though Jrue didn't start either of those first 2 games, you can already tell the difference just having him out there and, you know, giving Frazier, instead of playing just a ton of minutes, he did play 36 against in that second game, which was a pretty impressive win against Charlotte, but just giving those guys a role that is more conducive to what their actual talent is.
I want to talk also about how they're using AD and also perhaps why some of the switching defenses late have been effective in stopping him and why they've really struggled to score in some of these games, especially until Holiday came back. AD has already used 80 possessions as the role man. That is first in the league by a mile. He is great at getting open. He can get his mid-ranger whenever he wants. Second in the league is Miles Turner with 57. And AD at 1.1 points per possession, that's not amazing as a role man. What do you consider a lot of these? Are jumpers or taking a dribble for a floater. That's totally fine efficiency, especially also because he's able to get so many of those possessions. He also has 28 possessions coming off a screen so far, not shooting a great percentage on those, only 0.79 points per possession, but that's still useful in terms of the spacing, in terms of giving the defense something else to deal with, especially if he's playing at center. If he's getting a screen, the opposing center just is not going to be prepared to deal with that. He and Kristaps Porzingis, the only two players in the top 60 in terms of number of possessions coming off screens, really those are the only two bigs in the league who are doing that with any kind of regularity. Also, really encouraging for this team is where they've been on defense. You noted that they're 14th. I think they can start to improve in offense now that Holiday is back. He might even help the defense too, but that is so much better than they were last year.
It is, and a huge part of that is that they've been mitigating transition opportunities. It's been a more concerted effort. It's also a benefit of not playing as much of the stiff centers that they have. You know, they still are playing them some, but just playing them a little bit less. And second in frequency is more important than the efficiency they're giving up because the offense can exert or the defense can exert more control over it. They are giving up 1.23 per possession there, which is a lot, but I would expect that to change more than the frequency, which is more important.
Yeah, I mean, transition is kind of one of those things like opponent's 3-point percentage where it's much more important to stop the number than to say, oh, we're giving up a huge points per possession in transition. The sample size is so small. I mean, unless you're just giving up so many pick sixes in transition, there's usually not much of a correlation between how good your defense is. I mean, if the team is going in transition, it's because they think they have a good shot and they're taking it. Otherwise, they would just hold up. So there's not really such a thing as like, oh, we're really efficient in our transition defense. They're taking good shots. It's just a question of whether they're going to hit them in transition. But that is really good because last year, one of the reasons they took a step back was because they stopped offensive rebounding and they still couldn't stop anybody in transition. Now at least they're stopping people in transition. That's huge. And that to me, transition defense is one of the biggest things I look at in evaluating a coach. A big reason I thought that Alvin Gentry was not very good last year, and I think he's doing an improved job this year, even if it hasn't shown up quite as much in the record. I think he's done better this year along with Darren Erman, his lead defensive assistant.
New Orleans also has a very significant stretch, particularly with Drew coming back the next week or so. So they won on Saturday. They face Atlanta at Phillips on Tuesday, back-to-back, but returning home to face Minnesota on Wednesday. Then they fly to Portland and then Dallas. And so if they can go, I expect it to be 2-2, but if it's any better than that, then we're going to have to start talking about this team as being more competitive for the little bits of time that they can be full strength.
Well, it's interesting. They're six games under 500 right now. Do you think it's realistic for them to play 500 ball from here on out, or is that too rosy?
It's possible. I wouldn't say it's the most definite thing in the world, but if they can be healthy, I think they can play a little bit over 500.
Yeah, and you'll recall their over under, which I took the over on, I think was 37.5. So if they can just keep up a 500 pace from here on out, I think they'll actually they'll beat that for me.
Yeah, except AD's going to miss 15 games. So
yeah, I mean, he already missed one that they probably would have won on the road against Orlando. Man, Orlando, obviously this isn't the East, but man, those guys are getting lucky. Like, there's two games at home already that they played against like crippled opponents, one against John Wall, one against New Orleans, that were pretty close games that they won. If it hadn't been for those stars being out, like, Orlando could even be in like even more ridiculous trouble than they are. I mean, they've well outperformed their point differential.
Well, since we've made lone wolves a theme of this one, Anthony Davis fits the bill better than almost anybody. They've been minus 2.4 with 103.1 points per 100 possessions offensively, and they've been meaningfully worse. Not the same disparity as we saw with Russ or with Boogie. Minus 8.9 with a 90.1 offensive rating when Davis is on the bench.
From lone wolf to Timberwolves. Sadly, that's probably like the third best segue we've ever had on this show. We just do not do that. We are completely unpolished. We are just downloading information to your brain. That's the point of the show. Wolves 4-8, 3-4 since we last checked in on them when they were 1-4. Up until yesterday's debacle when they only put up 71 points in Memphis. They had the second best offense that's now dropped to fifth. Obviously, these things can change quite a bit. 21st in defense. And we've been critical a lot of them playing the two bigs together. That has helped, though, to the tune of 29% offensive rebounding, second in the league. And if you're that good on offense, maybe it doesn't matter that you're playing two bigs. Maybe Tibbs thinks they'll be better on defense. That's where they have to improve. So, and he thinks that playing two bigs is the way to do that.
There is an argument for it as long as you're doing well offensively. It's still frustrating because you think about just what they could be with the versatility, how they're using Towns, because he can take advantage of fours. Like there are physical things that he gets because he's just bigger than them. But I like him more with the quickness advantage than the speed one. You know, I like the quickness rather than power. And he's just such a phenomenal talent. He's shooting a lot of jump shots this year.
Yeah, I mean, he's especially from three, and he is shooting on catch and shoot threes, only 1.7 per game, but he's at 53% on those, 42% on his 1.9 pull-up threes per game. I mean, that's going to go down. I mean, I would still be pretty shocked if he shoots over 40% on the year from three. But if he's even in the high 30s, that's such a victory compared to where he's been at. And especially because he's had some pretty good volume. If you can't go under on him on the pick and roll, that really changes things a lot. And this team overall shooting 40% from three-point range. Again, I don't see that keeping up. I mean, the teams that overall have shot over 40% on three-point range, I mean, those are teams with like Steph Curry or like the Nash Suns, and some of like maybe I think one or two of those Spurs teams, like some of the great offenses of all time, you got to really be to shoot that type of a percentage on threes. These they do not have that level of shooting yet on this team, but still very encouraging that they're there. I think, do you think that their defense is better if they play two bigs?
Not necessarily, because it gives them an out to avoid, like I was talking with Dan Wilkie, and we'll talk about this a little bit with the Clippers, is that how the switching system has really activated some of their more passive defenders. And the same thing could be true for Minnesota, considering they have these players that are unusually athletic for their size.
Yeah, that's true. Towns certainly can switch a little bit. If you went with someone at the four, maybe even like a Bielitsa, you could do that more. I think the greater gain there, though, is just that their execution on this team is not very good. And maybe Tibbs thinks, hey, well, I got to teach him how to do this. But Deng has not really impressed me in pick and roll defense. I thought he was awful in that Charlotte game, for example, that we talked about last week. And Towns has not been as good in pick and roll defense. He has not been as good in traditional help responsibilities. They have some guys like Wiggins. Muhammad is a guy who's going to probably blow a lot of assignments, but when he's in the game one-on-one, he can probably, you know, he's strong enough to switch a little bit. I think that maybe they could be more effective doing that, but that's, you know, Tibbs wants to ice pick and rolls. He wants to keep stuff on one side of the floor. He wants to run his system. Switching is not nearly so much of what he likes to do. He likes to drop the bigs and protect the paint, and I think those bigs do need to learn how to do that at some point. So maybe he's viewing this as a little bit less, more of a learning season. Then again, you know, he probably wouldn't be playing Andrew Wiggins 42 minutes in certain regulation games if he was looking at that. But anyway, I think if you look at what their defense has been able to do, it's not very impressive so far. I might at least try to get some lineups in there that can do that and see what happens. And then the other thing that would do is it would enable Towns maybe to do a little bit more playing as the lone center. I took a look at that, and following up on what you did last time, Towns has been very effective in only 33 minutes without Aldridge and Deng. Last week, I think he'd only played 17, so he's basically getting like 3 minutes a game or something like that without another big on the floor. In those minutes, he is shooting 75%, but only 22 points on 14 shooting possessions. And the team, as you noted last week, still not scoring very well. And opponents are killing it in those minutes also. I mean, again, too small of a sample. This is more of a, hey, this is what's happened than this is necessarily predictive. But it is worth noting that they have not been effective in that alignment so far, despite the fact that it's something we think they should go to more.
It is asking a lot of the other players on their team to really get into it. But I also want to give credit to Andrew Wiggins beyond the whole crazy three-point shooting thing. He has been efficient in ways that people usually are not efficient.
Well, and he's over 1 point per possession on post-ups, over 1 point per possession on ISOs. Again, we talked about how those generally are not efficient plays, but he's been very good on post-ups really since his rookie year now. I think that's something that's real, that especially when he's being guarded by someone who's a little bit smaller of a wing, he really can get into the post and score. He's been very effective with his turnaround jumper. He gets fouled a ton. The ISOs, maybe not as much. would you expect that to continue? I mean, there are a lot of things about this efficiency that he's had so far where it's like, all right, this is stuff that people don't usually do, or it's a big leap. So you definitely think he's going to take a little bit of a step back. I mean, the more I've been thinking about him, especially when you consider his play in the other aspects of the game, which is not very good, I'm thinking of him as sort of like, for the time being, like a DeRozan who shoots threes, which is a pretty valuable player. DeRozan is going to grow to be a little bit less efficient than he has been so far. I think Wiggins will too. But the other good news is he's way ahead of where DeRozan was at this point in his career. And hopefully he can still, especially under a coach like Tibbs, get better in the floor game. But the longer it goes on without that, the more remote that possibility becomes.
And I'm sure people are going to love this. The other guy, because of the amount that they're actually giving him some pick and roll attitude, maybe there's a little bit of Rudy Gay in there too.
Yeah, I guess that's true, right? Especially the never passing. I mean, that's one thing. At least DeRozan, while he will take some bad shots, he will pass a little bit out of the pick and roll, which Gay and Andrew Wiggins do not really do necessarily. But Wiggins is getting to be more efficient, really, at this point right now than Gay has been at all but the best points in his career. All right, we'll get to a little bit news in a second. But first, a word from our good old friends at SeatGeek. If you are listening to this podcast, I would assume that you are a hardcore NBA fan, and the best place to get NBA tickets to see stuff in person that you're not necessarily going to see if you're watching on TV. One of the things that I think is actually important to see in person that I was noting when I was at Buck Shooter on the other day was that just a guy's shooting form. You know, you see it on TV and it doesn't look that jacked up. I was noting, like, Jabari Parker, for example. He looks like he has pretty good form. And then I noticed that he really actually releases the ball from almost like the left side of his head as a right-handed shooter. And he had some inconsistent mechanics. And when he was shooting around, I was like, all right, I can't really see that unless I'm there in person. So those are the type of things that you may notice if you're really someone who's super into the game. And on SeatGeek, you can get the best deals on every ticket in the house, wherever you want to sit, whether it's courtside, club seats, upper level, whatever it is. SeatGeek, always the first place to go to look for tickets to a game or, of course, a concert as well. SeatGeek has two things that really make it better, I think, than other sites. One is they do all the price comparison for you by searching multiple ticket sites and ensuring you get the best possible deal. You don't have to go to a bunch of different sites now. You just look at SeatGeek and it'll aggregate them for you. You don't have to worry that you're missing out by not going to another site. And they also help you get the most bang for your buck because it's given a grade based on value. And as you noted, Danny, you're in the ticket business. Those grades really match up with what your professional opinion is as well. And if there are any underpriced seats, we'll be able to find the best deals that'll fit your budget. And of course, my listeners can get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase by downloading that free SeatGeek app, going into the settings tab, clicking add a promo code, and you can enter promo code CAPSPACE. You guys know that's what the code is for pretty much everything that's on Dunked On, or it's a CAPSPACE URL. In this case, promo code CAPSPACE, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So download that free SeatGeek app, enter promo code CAPSPACE today. All right, let's get some news here before we go. What we got?
Paul George. So both Paul and CJ Miles did not play in the game that they won against the Thunder tonight. And then they also will not play in the game you are attending against the Golden State Warriors. Nate McMillan hopes they will return later in the week.
Yeah, and that's would at least indicate that this MRI that George had, the results were nothing too concerning if McMillan has that hope. George, as you'll recall, missed a game and then came back to play against the Cavs in the game that LeBron did not play. They won that game. And then now he still had some pain and he had to sit out again. You always wonder, again, when guys come back, play, and then they miss like a bunch more time, that's never really the greatest indication of how it was managed. But again, you know, if the player is saying he's pain-free and he's not, or maybe he is pain-free and then he plays and it swells up again, you know, sometimes you can't really avoid that. But nonetheless, he better get back soon. The fact that they won this game in Oklahoma City, not great for OKC, but really huge for the Pacers. I mean, they have not played well. They've been terrible on defense, and yet they're still hovering around 500. They've pulled out some close wins and they got lucky not having to play against LeBron. And LeBron, I think, has skipped like his last like three games in Indiana or something. I don't know what it is about Indiana. It doesn't want to play there. Maybe because he knows he has to go against Paul George. That's a good game for him to sit out. But yeah, I mean, that said, I mean, they're going to lose now to the Warriors very likely without those two guys, although it'll certainly be an exciting game.
And they have the Hawks and Clippers at home this week, too. So they need him for those games if they want to have
a chance. So they could very easily. I mean, if he doesn't get back for that, and again, you know, hoping they can return later in the week, I feel like, especially after he's already missed time, they usually end up being more conservative on those sorts of issues. Once he's tried to come back and he couldn't do it, they're going to make darn sure that he's ready. I mean, they could very easily lose all three of those games and then be a little bit behind the eight ball. I think they're at least lucky that there's no, like, that eighth seed in the East. I think that there is really nobody who's going to run away and hide with that. The top seven, though, are probably looking pretty good at this moment. JJ Barea, everyone was really freaking out after he suffered this injury. I think there was some concern that it was an Achilles, but it's a calf injury. He is out 6 weeks or so. Darren Williams, of course, re-injured his calf trying to come back and play against the Knicks. Who knows how long he's going to be out again? You know, we cautioned last time that those calf injuries can be tricky, and then he came back and, of course, re-injured it. And then, as a result, the Mavs signed Summer League sensation Jonathan Gibson, who averaged 40 a game in China last year. They released Quincy Acey, and he actually had like 16 points in the first half or something in their last game. The first one that he actually, I think that might have been his first NBA game.
Yeah, I think it might have been. And yeah, they have a lot of minutes now for point guards. Seth Curry's getting more. Gibson can do it. And they need a lot of offense, especially when Dirk is out. So Gibson will get a chance to get a lot of shots up.
Festus Ezeli, I think we noted before that he had some swelling as he tried to make his comeback. He is now seeking a second opinion on that knee. And it's really getting to the point now where you have to wonder, is there going to be now another surgery again for him? He already, you know, it's taken the path of getting that PRP treatment where he had to miss 6 weeks of activity as he kind of started trying to ramp up for the season after he had that knee surgery on his meniscus that he tried to play on mostly poorly in the playoffs last year. And so this kind of has the hallmarks of, all right, he's going to need another surgery, and it might be even a major surgery, and that his season could be imperiled. If he's not able now to come back, he's experienced swelling, nobody knows why, he's going to get a second opinion, all that not looking good.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, I've covered Festus his entire career before now. Nice guy and hard worker, but sometimes these things are out of your control.
Chandler Parsons has a bone bruise in his other knee, not the one that's been twice surgically repaired. He was just starting to ramp up, had a nice game against Dallas. He played a fair amount of minutes, but now this bone bruise, nothing major. He's supposed to be out for 2 weeks per our buddy Tim McMahon. And just a shame for this Memphis team that looked like they was really on a roll with this winning streak being the Clippers absolutely throttling two teams in a row. Dallas had 41 points after three quarters on Friday. And then last night, Minnesota, the number two offense, they hold them to 71. Like, that's fantastic. Parsons not a huge part of what the defense was going to be, but still a little bit of a blow for a team that looked like it was really starting to maybe cement itself as a solid playoff team when healthy. And part of the reason why they've looked so good, Tony Allen has come back from a groin injury. We'll talk a little about them on tomorrow's 15 and 60. But yeah, I mean, that he makes such a huge difference for their defense. One more signing here. The Pels sign Anthony Brown, the number 34 pick in 2015. He had been waived by the Lakers so they could keep Meta World Peace. The Pels waived Archie Goodwin, who had been signed for some shot creation to replace Lance Stevenson. Now that Holiday is back, they don't really need Goodwin. And Brown, just a guy they're hoping they can develop maybe into a 3-and-D guy. That's what he was supposed to be. The D part of the 3-and-D has never really worked out, neither is the 3, but a guy that's viewed as having some potential. And of course, the Pels desperately need someone who can fulfill those roles on the wing.
Yeah, I mean, the Pelicans are kind of making their own 10-day contracts in a way. You know, they're trying out these different guys, trying out these young players after they did Lance. Apparently Lance was in attendance at their last game, which I thought was maybe a sign that they were going to go back to him, but no, they went to Brown.
Well, but they can't because he has that groin injury. That's why.
Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot he was still hurt.
But I think he is, the idea is that they may re-sign him, and I think he's just rehabbing his injury still, you know, at the facility, which if he got hurt, they're actually, I think, required to let him do, and he's still going to get paid even though he was non-guaranteed until he's healthy
back
to play. Yeah, I didn't mean for you to have to chime in on Anthony Brown. Like, you know, I was going to go silent. And like, now you have to say some more about that. But good job actually coming up with something to say there. I was impressed by that. I was hoping you would go on to the next two items we have, which is that Rajon Rondo missed a couple of games with a sprained ankle, came back against the Clippers, and of course, led the team, led in quotation marks, with a negative 15. And, you know, they ended up blowing a 19-point lead and losing that game yesterday. And then D'Angelo Russell also back today against the Bulls after missing, I think, I can't remember if it was one or two games with a sore knee, but nothing important there, just maintenance apparently for him. And we'll see how he looks once he has returned. All right, we are done here. We'll be back tomorrow with more 15 and 60.
Can
the
I
rest
plug
of the
a couple things?
The West? Yes, I guess I will say who we are sponsored by after you do that.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing to close on. So the I have a piece. It's probably coming out Monday morning for the Sporting News on a John Wall renegotiation extension that cannot happen now, but could have happened over the summer. I recorded a Real GM Radio with Dan Wojcicki of the Orange County Register about the Clippers. I like doing a team-specific one in the first couple weeks of the year. Had that, and then normal stuff for The Athletic as well on the Warriors road trip that is still going, and you will be attending the finale.
All right, don't forget about those aforementioned sponsors. MeUndies, MeUndies.com/capspace. That will get you 20% off your first order at that URL and let them know that you came from us. Also, Movement Watches, MVMTwatches.com/capspace. That'll get you 15% off your order there. And of course, SeatGeek, capspace code gets you $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via rebates on the SeatGeek app. Talk to you all tomorrow.